Welcome to Legend Lore with Luis and Lauren, where we talk about Pathfinder 2nd Edition.
I'm Luis, and I'm a developer at Paizo working on the Pathfinder Lost Omens lines. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for over 15 years, and I've written for dozens of Pathfinder products. I'm also the GM for Valiant, and I write the Monsters Physique blog here on the No Direction Network.
And I'm Lauren, and I've been playing RPGs for almost 20 years. I write the Bend the Knee blog here on No Direction, and you can watch me play in the Adventurous and Three Ring Adventure podcasts. And this week, we're talking about Session Zero.
Before we get started with any of that, we want to mention that although we know a lot about what we're talking about when it comes to Pathfinder, we're not providing any kind of official rulings or answers. We're here to offer advice, and you can use that however you like. Remember that the official word from Paizo is the only official ruling out there. But don't forget, it's your game. Do what works best for your table. So, Lauren, you mentioned we're talking about Session Zero, and as the, I guess, resident GM of Legend Lore, I'll take charge this time.
Captain, my captain.
Yes. Let's talk about Session Zero. What is Session Zero, Lauren, if you want to clue our listeners into that first?
Session Zero is how you kind of get a consensus for the way the game is going to go between your players. You talk about what you want from the game, you talk about how to make that happen, and you generally help each other build this collaborative story.
Yeah, in short, Session Zero is getting together to set expectations for the game that you're about to play. And that can vary from explaining the home rules that you're going to use, house rules you're going to use, or the setting that you're going to play in and what kind of characters you're going to play with. A lot of different stuff. But Session Zero can be different from group to group. And I guess we're just going to talk about how we understand Session Zero and what we know about Session Zero for this particular episode.
And from what I've gathered, I think we come from, I'm not going to say very different places, but I think we come from very parallel places to how we do Session Zero. Now that I got to see the way you do Session Zero for our one shot of Legend Lore, I was very impressed, and I feel like I learned a lot from your method. My method is that I like to do almost all of that, but from a Word document that I send the players and then talk to them about via messaging.
So the episode, the Session Zero you're referring to is a special little, I guess, Legend Lore one shot that we're doing, that if you missed it, it came out as of this episode coming out. It was out yesterday, so you can head over to nodirectionpodcast.com, find Legend Lore Session Zero episode, and listen to that so you can maybe get an idea of what Session Zero is. But I feel like that was actually even a unique circumstance for me, because I was trying to set up a Session Zero for a brand new group of players, or at least brand new to Pathfinder 2nd Edition. Eleanor is literally brand new, and Meg is relatively brand new, so I feel like I asked specific questions and tried to set up specific things to more cater to new players compared to what I would normally do for Session Zero for my home group that I've been running with some as far back as literally my start of playing Dungeons & Dragons. So it varies, and I think Session Zero can be different things for different groups and different situations as well.
And I think that Session Zero is really where Batman excels, because Batman is, that's right, I'm still doing it, I'm doing the Batman test. There is nothing Batman can't beat, because he uses the Session Zero to prepare and plan for whatever adventure he's about to get into.
Yes, and not only that, but when Batman takes in a new ward or a new member to the Bat family, say a new Robin, he probably has to go through and explain everything that comes with the job of being a Bat family member, being a vigilante and all that stuff. So he has to explain, one, expectations about things like, oh, we don't use guns and we don't kill people. Two, like how to use all the different mechanics available to you, or if you will, the Bat Cave and all the different gadgets and stuff available. And then maybe even an explanation of how things are going to go, which could be shown as Batman taking someone on their first night out for patrol.
This is good, you know, and this is kind of making it feel like we have a good analogy for Session Zero. this is your montage to prepare for the adventure to come.
Yes. And mind you, the montage probably won't prepare you for everything, but it's going to set up a lot of ground rules and set up enough information, set up enough knowledge to hopefully get you through all the tricky bits. And if not, you know what? Session zero doesn't necessarily have to always come at the beginning or only happen at the beginning. You might be able to reconvene with the group and reestablish new house rules or make changes to the setting or the story and stuff as you go along. So don't imagine session zero is always at the very beginning of a campaign. It's just whenever you and your group need to figure out, hey, do we like how things are going, or what do we want to have our game be? You can reconvene and do that again.
The real session zero was the friends we made along the way.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about a few different things that you could include in your own session zero, which, you know, you don't have to include it. All of these, you can just include one or two, but the big important thing, I think, is creating a dialogue with your group. And even if you don't have a proper sit down, we're going to chat for 2 hours to figure out what our campaign is going to be. As long as you and your group are willing to converse and figure out what you want out of your game and how you might change that along the way, I think that's totally fine. People who have been in groups where your GM makes a ruling on the fly and then maybe chats with the group after the session to decide, oh, do we want to keep that ruling, or do we want to follow what the course, the rules say, or do we want to, you know, maybe tweak that our own way? That's, in a way, its own kind of session zero, just in a microcosm, where you chat together and figure things out for your game. So session zero, use as little or as much of what we're about to talk about here for whatever you need with your group.
I think, yeah, I'm ready to get into discussion.
Let's do it. So I think the very first thing we'll talk about is the players, because they are obviously the biggest part of the group, for there are typically a lot more of them than there is a GM. But one thing I like to discuss with my groups, particularly my home groups that I've been running a lot with for many years now, is what kind of player options they can expect or to look at for the game. So in particular, some examples I've done where I also made a big Word document and sent it off to my groups, and I said, all right, here are the available races you can play in the game, or now they would be ancestries. You know, just setting that. So if I'm doing an adventure path, for example, that's set in a particular part of a world, I might say, all right, you have tieflings available because you're in Cheliax, but you wouldn't have something like androids available to pick as an option for your character. So that kind of stuff is, I think, very useful for session zero, letting players know, hey, we're using these specific rules that are in the game, and I don't want anything from outside of these sources to keep within the theme or the kind of feel that you're going for in the game. And of course, that's a back and forth. I have had players that say, well, I know you mentioned this, but would it be fine if I had an orc? It's like, oh, maybe, if you can sell it to me the right way.
I've had a lot of feedback from players in the past who've said they really didn't like feeling limited by having guidelines put forth like that. Hey, most of the races are this and this and this. How do you address that to those players?
I think what I've done is typically give them just enough options where painting within the lines, coloring within the lines, that this following the specific guidelines isn't severely limited. So I say, you know, you have your core ancestries, you have, you know, these four other ancestries, and then, like, I guess for Pathfinder 2nd Edition, I would say, you know, you have your core ancestries, you have these five other ancestries available, and then you have these five versatile heritages. If you can't figure out an interesting character with, at that point, 11 ancestries and five versatile heritages, then I don't think it's that you're limited. You know, I think you're just wanting a very specific thing to play and suddenly get sad that you get shut out. But that's a different thing than feeling like you've been not given enough options.
The home group that I grew up with was largely looking at, they had a build they wanted to try with a particular ancestry that they wanted to use, and they are ready to throw that into any story that you throw at them. That's how I kind of came up with my whole Word document session zero of this is the plot that we're going into. This is what the world's like. This is what the races are like. Make something that fits it.
Yeah, I try not to limit class options in particular, but other stuff like your ancestries or, you know, maybe what prestige classes were available and things like that. Those I did limit, but the core classes and the base classes, I think I tend to keep the same just because that is, I think, more limiting than shutting out something like, oh, well, you can't play a Tengu here.
Mm-hmm. And this ties into setting the theme in your session zero. Yes. 'Cause even if you won't say, please don't play an Oracle, you might tell the players, hey, Oracles are kind of rare in this setting, or, you know, they're more uncommon. You can play one if you want, but you're not going to run into a bunch of them.
Yeah. Or similarly, you know, you can play an orc here, but you're going to be the only orc and you might stand out and that will draw attention to you. And yeah, in a positive vein where you want to reinforce the particular themes, you can say, hey, all the core ancestries plus the orc is available because, you know, you might be playing a campaign where orcs are nearby or you're in that region where there are orcs around, and, you know, that would encourage players to kind of lean into the themes of stuff where, hey, it's an orc heavy campaign, come on, bring an orc, you'll have a lot of stuff to do with an orc compared to having nothing to do with like a rat folk or something, for example.
And if you tell your players that in this setting there are going to be more orcs, so feel free to play one, and there are going to be a lot of alchemists, feel free to play one, not only are you helping them build a character that will fit the world better, you're also already planting the seeds of world building in their head.
Yeah. Another thing to consider with theme expectations is like just the rating of the game. Is it going to be big, gory, R-rated, hack and slash, you know, dark themes fest, or is it more action-y, PG, PG-13 kind of stuff? Setting those themes here can be very useful, and it's something I think we'll touch on in just a bit, but a lot of that does come down to themes. Do you want it to be comedic? Do you want it to be action-y? Do you want it to be dark and brooding, or do you want it to be mysterious and scary? You know, there's lots of different themes you can set here as part of that, and that might be something you work with your group to decide, or you might, as a GM, decide, hey, here's what we're shooting for. Please try to aim towards that.
The last time I started a campaign as a GM, I presented three different themes to my players beforehand and said, which one of these stories would you like to go through? And they ultimately chose the one that was kind of my version of Game of Thrones at the time. Mm-hmm. But man, I was real disappointed that they didn't take the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure route. That was one of my choices. It was kind of a cross between that and Tenacious D and The Pick of Destiny, where, I don't know, it's just this typical, I was going to give them all a free multi-class. It was Gestalt back before we had that, and they were all going to be bards. All of them are multi-class bard. And I was going to write interesting mechanics for if they all perform at the same time, it could synergize, and... No, they didn't take that one. They thought it was too silly.
Yeah. Well, silly can be just fine if that's what you're shooting for.
But this is the strength of the session zero, though, because if the players can right here highlight, we're not super interested in this story, in this theme, you just nix it right there. And they had a great time in the game that we did play.
There you go. There is you'll realize that a lot of these different subjects that we're covering actually kind of wind and intertwine a lot. They're kind of hand in hand. So one thing that you'll figure out hopefully with your session zero is what your players are planning to play and whether or not that will clash with the theme. So if you have a, you know, dark, mysterious, gothic horror styled game and suddenly someone decides to play the Bill and Ted Bard, like, that might not work for your game, or at least the game that you're trying to shoot for, and might be something that, you know, you try to address right then and there in your session zero rather than saying, hey, everyone bring a character, and suddenly they don't know what to bring and they bring whatever and it doesn't work with the story you're trying to tell or you're all trying to enjoy. So, tying into the theme is also the setting that your game is going to take place in, your be it a one-shot adventure or your overall campaign. I think knowing the setting, you know, this is a world where there is little magic, will help influence character ideas and also help, I think, cement the theme for your group. If you know that it's got low magic, it might be darker and grittier as a whole, but yeah, you know, those two kind of come hand in hand, and letting everyone know that that's the type of world that you're in, and maybe the kind of creatures that they'll encounter, the enemies they'll encounter, that maybe the factions at play, stuff like that, as much or as little as you want to give, but I think those end up reinforcing the themes and ideas that you're kind of shooting for with both your player option expectations and your theme expectations.
Now, something I like to use to help set the tone right in the session zero is house rules. Hear me out. You can tell a different story depending on which rules you've created in your head.
Yeah.
And you're also kind of giving your player... Let me give an example. In my grim, dark fantasy world, where it was kind of inspired by Game of Thrones, I had a house rule that there's no resurrections. If you die, you're dead. And anytime you go unconscious in combat, right, you get some kind of disfigurement. You get some type of scar to remind you of this quote-unquote failure. Letting your players know up front about these house rules lets them prepare for it. It kind of informs the way that they're going to play, and also continues to establish some of that setting, some of that tone in their head.
Yeah, and house rules can, like you said, they reinforce the theme and ideas, and they can do so in the opposite end as well. Like, if you give everyone the Gestalt or the free archetype or dual class rule, suddenly they realize they have more power and should feel more powerful, and then that kind of reinforces that as well. But your house rules don't always have to tie into the theme and all the other expectations you've been set, and sometimes you just tweak the game because you want it to play a particular way that doesn't have anything to do with any of the other stuff going on. For the longest time, up until I think very recently when I was using a lot of virtual tabletop stuff, we just ignored the rule where every other diagonal movement costs you more of your speed. So just diagonals.
That's so annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, diagonals were free. Everyone can do it. So that meant monsters can do it. So it's not like, you know, the players are getting anything that put them at a great advantage or anything, but it's just how we used to do it for the longest time, and just a lot faster and easier to work with. But now that a virtual tabletop can tell you exactly what your distance is, you know, it's not so bad. But, you know, that kind of stuff, or adding in things like, oh, everyone starts with a free magic weapon or something like that. That could be a house rule that, depending on if you're doing that just to... Or Lauren, for example, even your everyone starts at level 2 rule. That
I love that. That is my house rule. Everyone starts at level 2.
That is a kind of theme neutral rule. It works for everything. The only theme it kind of reinforces is that the players are a bit stronger. But I mean, you can still have a game where it's grim and tough and hard, and the players are at disadvantage every turn. It just happened to have started at level 2, and then it starts happening to them.
And let me defend myself here. I don't do it because I want them to be a little bit more powerful. I do it because, as somebody who prides herself in being able to build almost any character concept, I judge a system, any system, by how quickly you can do that. In first edition, sometimes, man, I'd have to get a character to like level 12 before I felt like they were a realized concept. In this edition, most of the time you can do that by level 2. Yeah. Which is why I like to start at level 2.
Yeah, and that's a thing I'm actually going to be doing with my upcoming Iron Fang Invasion campaign. I'm giving everyone the free archetype, so the free archetype variant, so everyone gets, you know, something like Archer or Cavalier or whatever, for to kind of fit their character ideas and not have to feel like they're losing out on class abilities and stuff like that, and ultimately have a more interesting character, I think. So
I think and I was going to ask you what your favorite house rule is, but you've hit mine already, and it's that one, the free archetype rule. Mm-hmm. At every level right now, you choose either, what, a class feat or an archetype feat, right? But why not both? You think about it. It's just such a natural fit when you really put it in perspective. You're like, man, this is great. I can have my cake and eat it too. And isn't that what we're here for? We're here to play role-playing games to have our cake and eat it too. That's why we're not doing something else.
Yep. I think, I don't know if I have favorites that like, oh, I can't play without this. You know,
none of those?
I've included and then dropped house rules all the time. So even now, the longest house rule standing in my games was the free diagonals, and now that's gone. I had, for a while, I liked during first edition what was called the glancing blows. So if your attack missed by within 5, you still did a little bit of damage, so it didn't feel like you missed out on stuff. But yeah, in a way that's kind of reminiscent of Pathfinder 2nd Edition's degree of success. You might get a success, but not full damage or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think the one I've enjoyed the most, or at least has made the games most enjoyable, is the way I've dealt with my 3-player games. For the longest time, I only had 3 players in my campaigns, which means that a lot of the game assumptions about party size and stuff aren't being met. So I had to shore up the loss of power somehow. So what I would do is give everyone a free skill that they choose at first level that just automatically gets maximum ranks or gets full proficiency and stuff. So they can feel like they have extras to contribute to the party. So, you know, if someone doesn't have lockpicking or whatever, cool. I'll use that, my free one, for that. I also gave them an array of free feats, so something like toughness or at least in first edition, iron will or great fortitude, stuff like that, to beef them up a little bit. And then I occasionally would throw in extra rewards here and there, like an extra feat, or at least in second edition would be like an extra skill feat or extra general feat, that I would use to kind of make up for the lack of a third person. And I think it was very easy to add more or slow down on how much I was giving away depending on how the party was doing. So it made them feel like they were never lacking in a party member, and then they got to do extra cool stuff. So, you know, that's what everyone likes to do.
And just as a side note, I honestly prefer 3-player parties over anything else.
Me too.
I think that the intimate connections and relationship that the characters can build amongst each other is just so much more interesting. And then their backstories really come into play. It's a little bit easier to work all of their personal histories together.
Yeah, everyone gets the spotlight a bit more than they would with an extra player there. Which, yes, as you're saying, backstories are, I think, a thing that can come up in Session Zero, not necessarily has to be decided. One thing I guess I should know is at the end of Session Zero, you don't necessarily have to have everyone's characters built and ready to go, but I think as long as everyone is on the same page, so then they're ready to go on their first proper session, I think that's really the big thing. So you can have people, have players decide their backstories and the like at Session Zero. Whether or not it's mandatory is up to you, but I think having just a one sentence idea of, oh, I'm a ranger that is in this for the money, is probably good enough for a good start for most groups.
And what's nice about having that done in the Session Zero is that then, Luis, you in particular have a good week or 2 weeks to plan how to use those backstories and run that story.
Yes, definitely. And, you know, if those backstories never come up again, that's fine. But I think getting backstories also helps players get into the mindset of their characters and understand who they are. And that just hopefully leads to better role-playing and more fun at the table.
So let's talk about the future connections that can be made in the Session Zero.
Yeah. So what this can be, this can be tied to something in the backstory where someone might mention, oh, my old teacher who taught me how to fight has gone missing, and I'm looking for them. You know, that's something that's from your backstory that might get resolved in the campaign itself. It may never come up again, but it's up to you and the player to decide whether or not that's something that you want to see resolved at the table. I had memories of a game I was in where someone mentioned, oh, there's this guy who wronged me in the past and he's a jerk, and because of that I decided to be a wizard or whatever. That's the basic gist of it. And eventually our GM tried to bring that character back, but the player actually didn't like that. He didn't agree to it, but two, he's like, yeah, that guy was some jerk in my past and I never want to see him again. I want to forget about him. I decided to become a wizard to forget about people like that in my past and all that stuff. So seeing them is not something I wanted to encounter. I wanted to escape all of that. And, you know, had we had a session zero, I think we might have been able to establish that, like, this is my backstory, but I don't want it to interfere with what I'm doing in the present day. And that, I think, is just as important as knowing, oh, yeah, have that character come back. I want to see them and I want to resolve my cool backstory.
And that's... this is why when I'm setting up some of this in my Word document, I'll ask the players, I'll say, hey, from your backstory, please give me some hooks that I can work with. And this is where that player could have said, this isn't one of those hooks.
Yes.
And they could have given you something else to work with.
Yeah. Or they might have just decided, I don't want any hooks. I am interested in the present day campaign, what's going on there, you know. If we were playing an adventure path and basically that player decided, I want to only focus on the adventure path, you coming up with stuff from outside of it, pulling in my backstory, it's not what I want. Have you had much success incorporating any of these connections into your games later on, Lauren?
Actually quite a bit, but more because our group was always the GM would homebrew the story group. I can count on one hand the number of times we've done an adventure path to completion. It's just not what we do. But I kind of used the backstories of the characters to kind of write the story, you know? Or I would say, I know that I need a big bad guy for this. What if it's secretly the uncle of this character? Or what I would do is I would have some major NPCs already known. I've already fleshed out who the major NPCs are. Now I'm going to create a family for that. I'm going to ask some of the players, hey, if you want it to be from one of these families, that would fit the story. Going on to, again, in the beginning, where you kind of give them some of the lore of your world and then tell them they can use it if they want to. The players who choose to are just buying into your hooks. Yeah, it's worked pretty well in the past for me.
I feel like I've had not as much success as you have because I run so much adventure path and pre-written material. Players will name drop things or something, and I will try to remember to incorporate it, but it's hard enough to like keep track of all the AP stuff already. I think it's happened a few times, but none of my players seemed particularly upset of missing out on that. So I think maybe if players are giving you these connections, you know, reminding them here and there that I may forget to include them, or, you know, is it fine if they don't end up coming up with anything and we have a different adventure altogether that just doesn't brush on that, I think is a good thing to sort out as well.
Yeah. It all depends on what they are looking for and what you as a GM are looking for. You know, they're allowed to have their wants out of the game, and you are too.
Yeah, and those wants can change as the game goes on. You know, someone could become more invested in the current plots and say, you know what, that guy I mentioned in my past, forget about it. I care now about what's going on here. And that's totally fine. So once we have all these expectations and maybe characters already ready to go, I think the hardest... or one of the hardest things is deciding how the group has come together. Where are all these player characters meeting? Do they know each other? Is it by chance that they meet in the first session? Did they get hired by the same person? There's different ways you can do that, and I think involving players with that can be a really fun thing.
I've always found that this is one of the greatest strengths of the Session Zero, because not establishing this and then having your first game open with you start out in a tavern, it has become the worst. It is such a cliche, and it just instantly pulls out any immersion that you were trying to get, because it's just so ubiquitous. But this is a great time to say, to just ask your players, be thinking about how you know each other. Or as a GM, maybe you don't even need to come up with that. Maybe you have already planned out how they're going to get to know each other. That's what I was doing with the most recent game, is I told them to come up with these characters. I honestly had them do it kind of independently from each other, so they couldn't form connections, because I knew how I wanted to force them together, how I wanted to create this bond between the players. And ultimately, that's really what you need, what you're trying to do here. You're trying to figure out what the bond is between the characters.
Yeah, they could be someone that, or a group that has, you know, because of the circumstances, been brought together, or they could have been already a notable group beforehand. I think from my experience with Adventure Pass, they run the gamut of different ways to be brought together. Some are, you by chance happen to be within the same city block of each other, and you know, a fight breaks out and you all work together. And some, hey, you all knew this particular person and were already an adventuring party and stuff like that. So it can vary. And if you don't resolve it right then and there in the session zero, that's fine. I think you can also sort that out at the beginning of the first session and get that sorted out. And like Lauren suggested, maybe you go in knowing that it's not going to be sorted out until that first session starts and you know, the first dice are rolled.
One of my favorite, I don't know if we're going to do a whole episode on the first session of a game. Listeners, comment on our Discord. Let us know if you want to see an episode on the first session of a new campaign. But one of my favorite, I love this so much. It's going to become a meme the more games I group. I like to start a game with the first words out of my mouth at session one being roll for initiative.
Yep.
And this can sometimes be a really good way to bring characters together, right? Like, as they slowly, they don't know anything. You give them no background whatsoever. Roll for initiative. What? All right, and then you place, and the story writes itself.
Yep. So once you've gone through most of session zero, you probably have figured out what everyone wants, what everyone's looking for, what you want for your game, assuming you're the GM, what the campaign wants and stuff. But there's, like I mentioned earlier, a chance that someone doesn't want a particular thing to show up. Not that they, something that they actively don't want to show up. If someone is not into spiders and they don't like seeing spiders or even hearing or talking about spiders, they can tell you right then and there, hey, please don't include any spiders. And I think actively asking players and the entire table, what don't you want to see? What do you want me to avoid? What do you want me to not include in the game? Is very important. Asking for, you know, please don't have anything that depicts violence against children. You know, that can be important to people. Don't, you know, spiders, or it might even just be like, please don't describe blood and stuff like that. That happens. Or if someone had a bad time with a troll before, it's like, can we not fight any trolls, please? You know, it could be something like that, or even just something a little silly. It's, you know, that feels silly to you, but might still be important to the player. That's fine. Set those expectations there. But I think the other important thing you can do is set up a system so anyone can notify the group when something has come up that they don't want to see. The core rule books refer to the X card, which is just a very simple system. It's a card with a big X. You hold it up when something is happening that you don't want to be happening anymore. So if, for example, you enter a cave and suddenly you describe a spider and no one thought to mention that I don't like spiders, and they hold up the X card, all you do is you just say, oh, okay, that's not what's happening. You might change it to, oh, instead of a spiders, it's a giant scorpion. Or it might be, you know, a pack of kobolds now or whatever, but setting up both the expectations of what not to include and also how to notify the entire group to not deal with that anymore is, I think, very important. And if you want, you might be able to set up guidelines with your group where you can discuss it and maybe sort out, hey, can I talk about not necessarily spiders, but can I include cobwebs and stuff? Yeah, sure, that's fine. You know, and you can sort that out as things come up. But I think it's very important to set those, set where the line is and draw those lines for everyone on the group.
And I want to take a minute to just stress something to you players out there. I get that our society kind of discourages us from showing weakness or, you know, like not toughing it out for something. Don't tough it out for this. This is a game that we play to have fun. Look, even I have an X card, and at the start of games or when I think it's going to come up, I'll stop and I'll tell the GM. I'll say, hey, please do not forcibly transfigure my character. Like, do not hit me with a polymorph effect. Do not hit me with a baleful polymorph. I cannot handle it. You can hit me with all of the effects of it. You can say that I'm temporarily stupid or whatever you want. Just do not tell me that, like, my nose grows, like, 6 feet or something. Like, I can't handle it. I don't know what it is, but something about that just rubs me the wrong way. And I don't owe anybody any explanations either. I can just say, this really doesn't resonate with me. Please don't include it. Right? Players, don't be afraid. Do not be afraid to tell your GM that, right? They would rather hear that from you than just put something in there that's going to make you extremely uncomfortable and pull you out of the game. And if they're not that kind of person, if they would rather not hear it, this is not your friend. This is not somebody that you really want to be playing with.
Yeah, and this, I mean, ultimately, it's all coming down to consent, right? And it's entirely possible that you are choosing to enter a game and everyone else is, you know, in agreement to enter a game where uncomfortable things might happen. And that's fine because everyone has agreed to it. So if you're playing something that's more in the horror genre and there might be, you know, as long as you let everyone know, hey, there might be more like blood and gore and stuff like that, and there might be descriptions of it, everyone can be cool with it. But again, as long as you also have that out where someone might decide, oh, suddenly I don't want to hear about it, or this particular scene is too gruesome or whatever, and then use an X card or whatever it is that you've set in place, that's cool too. We're not saying you can't have uncomfortable situations in your game or never include spiders ever again or anything like that. It's just being able to communicate when things have gone too far or might be nearing going too far. You know, it doesn't have to reach that point where someone is in tears and crying and upset about the situation. If it's just, you know, you start describing something or something starts happening in the game and you might fear that it would be too much, that's all right to stop it right then and there as well. So, you know, just be willing to communicate that. It's just as important as being willing to communicate what is coming into the game and what to expect in the game as anything else, I feel.
Yeah. So I've been kind of accused before of my Word documents being too long. And <Yeah. laughs> and I'm trying to include too much in my session zero. Well, how do I cut the fat, right? What are some things I can kind of get out of there?
Oh, I think it's very easy to get wordy about why you're including something. So, you know, you might say, oh, I'm giving everyone a free archetype for this, that, when you can just be like, here are the five house rules we're playing, free archetype, blah, 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 and that's it, you know. Or you can give everyone the bullet points of the theme instead of going into very specific about here's all the different factions and, you know, here's all the different noble houses that are you're dealing with. You can just say something like, it's very intriguing, lots of intrigue and lots of you know, politics to deal with. Done. You know, you don't have to give it a full 2-page breakdown of the entire history of all the different noble houses. Just it's intrigue and politics, and that should give people, I think, the right idea. If you can, I think, trim it down to 2 pages, you probably can cover most of everything. If not, that's fine. But it's very easy to take down what you have and parse it down into just simpler, very bullet point ideas. So, Lauren, considering you've asked me a question, I feel like so did our listeners. And look at that. We have lots of questions here from our patrons and fans here. Starting here first with our patron Folkland, who asks, how can you get someone who's reluctant to have any ties to other PCs to actually tie themselves with PCs and do so without dragging them kicking and screaming into someone else's backstory?
Well, you can't, but you also can. So, if somebody who doesn't want their backstory to tie into other backstories, look, you have to put a check mark on it. Okay, that's fine. But that doesn't mean the point of tying backstories together is so that you form a relationship between the characters, which is going to improve and enrich the story. That doesn't have to be a backstory situation, though. You can have the Lich cast a spell on them, which goes wrong, and now the souls of two characters are linked, right? That just happened in the game. It's not a backstory thing, but now you're still forming a relationship between these two characters, which will enrich the story.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar. Form the bonds in play rather than in the backstory. That very first session you have, you know, you sit down, Lauren says, roll for initiative, and what happens is suddenly the rogue has to learn how to fight with the fighter, even though they don't know each other, and maybe quickly start developing a relationship on the battlefield and realize, oh, I like fighting with this person. Let's get to know each other. Now we're friends. There, you did it. It just happened in the game rather than by saying, oh, yeah, we're friends from back in high school.
Okay, and let me stress one more time how good of an idea that is to begin with roll for initiative. Your players have just spent all this time building their characters, thinking about the story. You know, they want to play the game. What better way than to immediately cast the die and get the action going, right? You're setting a tone for the game. And the excitement just right up front, you know? From patron Andrew Mullen, for a published adventure, do you have any tips on creating a robust backstory without setting up the expectation that the GM has to make these big alterations to the module? Basically, how do you strike a balance between being specific enough to be interesting, but general enough to fit with the events of the adventure?
I think if you're running a published adventure, the GM should be able to tell you, here are specific things to keep in mind or specific things to shoot for. For example, the Pathfinder Adventure Paths, I'll have a player's guide that say, everyone should be from this town, or everyone should be willing to go out and fight demons at the World Wound or whatever, stuff like that. And that they typically give you a broad enough idea that you can paint within the lines and still have lots to do and do it your particular way. You just kind of shoot for that particular mindset of, oh yeah, I gotta make a demon hunter, or I gotta make, you know, a treasure hunter, or I gotta make someone who's gonna be a police officer in Absalom, or whatever the case might be.
Something I like to do either as a GM or as a player is I like to use family names as a way of kind of tying into the basic story. When I'm a GM, I'll say, hey, this is one of the notable families that will be a part of this. If you'd like to build a character from this family, you can. As a player, I'll ask for those kind of family names. Or as a player, you can even broaden it a little bit further. You can say, hey, who are some of the notable NPCs that I can build a backstory involving?
And I think also, like I mentioned earlier, don't necessarily expect that the GM will be able to include all of your backstory stuff. As long as you're willing to follow the adventure and be part of the story that's going to be told, I think you're going to be good. It might be that the GM is cool enough to, you know, include all of your cool backstory stuff and change the adventure all for that. But if they don't, I think you're still going to have a good time if you're willing to be part of the story that's going to be told. Next question here for my patron, Chris Kimball, who asks, as a player, I have a hard time letting the party be unbalanced, such as not having a healer or spellcaster. And I know everyone should play what they want, but if the group is handicapped because we lack too many skills, I feel everyone suffers. Is that something players should self-police or something the GM should call out or adapt to?
The answer is yes to all of the above. And also, no, again, because don't worry about it. All right, look. Just play what you want to play, y'all. Like, just have a good time, you know? If you want to play, if you're like, man, I know going into this, I want to be an elf rogue. I want my character to be good at these things. Do that. Everybody should do exactly that. But then it's okay to think, well, we kind of don't have anybody who's good at survival. Maybe one of us should do it. And see who can fit survival into their build. And this is, again, a great strength of Session Zero, is you can kind of hash out a lot of this stuff. But on top of that, this also is something the GM should kind of be a little cognizant of. If just absolutely nobody is interested in being the healer, right? Or having any ability to heal in their party, it's fine. Like, the GM shouldn't say, none of you all have a healer. The GM should say, maybe I should put some more health potions in their loot. Maybe I should put some more wands of healing in their loot. Let them play the way they want to play and just work around it.
Yeah. Another thing beyond that is maybe you will decide to change as the game goes on. You might get tired of having to continue to buy potions and wands and the like to heal, and decide, okay, next time I level up, I'm going to train in medicine and start doing all the healing stuff. And that's fine too. You can adapt based on how things are changing with your game, and the GM can also do the same. It's very easy to realize, oh, I thought they had enough to cover all the, you know, different arcana and magic checks that they were going to do, but they don't necessarily, so maybe they'll find a cool magic item that boosts that up a bit or gives them some help, and, you know, adapt as the game goes on. It's one great thing about tabletop RPGs is they're not a computer game. They're, you know, a computer game is programmed with what it's programmed into, and if the developers didn't think of something, there's no way to go and make that change. But GM and the players can adapt the game as needed to fit what they're trying to do and the story they're trying to tell.
From patron Dom, a lot of RPGs include world building in Session Zero. But how much of a place does world building have in Pathfinder 2nd Edition, where Galarian is already pretty strongly integrated?
Well, you see, the setting doesn't have every single building and every single inch of the entire world described in the books. There's a lot of room to play with in there. If you're the GM, you can say, all right, everyone's starting in this town, and show them the map of the town that's already printed and give them the details of all the NPCs that exist there and all the shops and stuff, and realize, oh, but there's still, like, you know, 80% of the buildings here in town that are unaccounted for. Which one is your house? Where do you live? You know, and the players can build off of that. You can provide setting information and say, oh, we're going to be playing in the lands of the Lindorm Kings, and that the player can ask, hey, is there a chance that there is a fishing shop in the town that we're in? And there might not be already, but you as a GM can also decide there is now, and add that in, and, you know, accommodate for what the players are looking for. You can take the existing world and just build upon it, and do that in Session Zero or as time goes on in your games.
I feel like letting the players know up front that you will say as much there is now as you can is just a good thing. Let the players know that this is a shared world building experience, and that ultimately we're playing an advanced board games here, right? Like, you could just take a country off the map of Galarian if you felt like it, you know?
Yep.
And on top of that, how many cities in Galarian are not in any of the books, right? Countless.
So many.
Just make up cities. Just make up regions. Literally nobody cares, you know? It'll just be fun. Just have a good time with it.
Final question here from our patron Boyd, who asks, when running a Session Zero, especially for a homebrew setting, how do you thread the needle for letting the characters know that there's room for them to world build with their backstory while preserving the overarching plot you're planning on anchoring to the campaign?
It's a good question. I'm think I need a minute to think about it.
Sure. I think I would say that the plot is not so important that it can never change based on what's happening. And also, in the inverse, the players can't adapt to what's going on with the story. But I think the plot should be more flexible compared to what the players are doing, because they're the ones playing. It's ultimately their story. If you want to run a big story where everything plays out the way you are imagining it in your head, please just write a novel and try something else instead, because that's not what RPGs are necessarily all about. There are times when a player will break the story or figure something out in advance, or maybe just turn left when you expect them all to turn right, and you're gonna have to learn to adapt, be that, you know, just placing everything on the left path rather than the right path, or deciding, oh well, they caught the bad guy early and killed them. Turns out he has a letter on him that says, ah, thank you, my minion, I'm the real bad guy, and then now there's more plot to go on, or it spins off in a different direction. That is how it is, and your players can go in and decide, hey, I'm from this town that didn't exist when you were first coming up with this, or I know someone in this city, and you have to figure that out. And I think that's fine, just as long as they're not doing things like, ah, I was born the ultimate hero of the dragon lineage, and that means I can do a million damage when I breathe my fire breath that I have now. That's fine. Let the players add on to the world where they see fit, and include it in the game and in the plot where it makes sense.
Yeah, and kind of piggybacking on that, let me say that if you're running a homebrew setting and not a published adventure path, kind of the strength of that is that it is a flexible plot, and it doesn't have to be preserved or anchored. Like, it's allowed to be very mutable. That's one of the strengths of it. You know, let the players do what the player's gonna do, and they're really gonna feel like they're not on the rails. Like, they're kind of influencing the story and changing the outcome, making their own fate, so to say.
Yeah, and the best part about homebrew stuff is when a player decides, oh, I think this is what's going on with the story, and then you can just say, yep, you got it, and they feel so great when they figured out the plan that you obviously changed to accommodate their theories.
No matter how good your session zero is, eventually it has to end, just like this episode, because that's all we have for today. Make sure you check out the rest of our content on the No Direction Network. If you like this show or any of our other blogs or shows, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/nodirection, because it's the support of our patrons that make this all possible.
Until next time, I'm Luis.
And I'm Lauren.
Thanks for listening to Legend Lore. And as always, it's been legendary.